Early this morning, authorities in Maryland arrested two men in connection with the series of sniper attacks in the Washington, D.C. area. They are believed to be John Allen Muhammad, a 41-year-old Army veteran who converted to Islam about a year ago, and 17-year-old John Lee Malvo. As yet, they have not been charged with any crime in connection with the sniper case. Authorities have repeatedly warned reporters not to jump to conclusions, but there appears to be good reason to hope that the sniper case may have been solved. 24 hours ago, the investigation seemed mired. There were complaints of disorder and incompetence in the organization of the task force and, at the same time, a series of cryptic communications with the sniper that included the release of ominous threats against children. Then, late yesterday, a series of developments enabled police to come up with descriptions of men and a car. An alert motorist called in a tip. And then early this morning, authorities arrested two men as they slept in their car at a rest stop on an interstate highway near Frederick, Maryland. A rifle found in the car is being tested. We'll follow this story through stops in Alabama and in Washington State in a few minutes, and we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the story and the investigation? If you live in the Washington area, are you breathing a little easier now, or are you still on pins and needles? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin our coverage with NPR's Larry Abramson. He joins us here in Studio 3A with the latest on the investigation. Larry, I know you've been up very late. We appreciate your being with
That's
us.
That's nice to be here, Neil.
What is the latest? Where are we now? What do we know and what don't we know?
Well, here, we know that two men have been arrested. As you said, we aren't 100% certain that it is the two people, John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo, who were issued arrest warrants last night. But that seems to be the case. There was a dramatic arrest at this rest stop, as you mentioned. Somebody really within a couple of hours after the time that Chief Moose put out this alert for citizens to help track down this Chevrolet Caprice, and he gave a license number, phoned in to 911. Police appeared very quickly and made an arrest at about 3:30 this morning. Police have been very careful with this car. It could be full of a lot of really important evidence. It took them, I think, 7 hours before they packed it up into a trailer and brought it down to Montgomery County, Maryland, again, trying to preserve every bit of evidence and also trying to be sure that they got a search warrant so they could look around and try to find evidence that, in fact, this was the car that had been used in the shootings. However, these men have not been charged with anything yet. Originally, Chief Moose said that this man, John Allen Muhammad, was wanted on previous warrants, and that is he had been issued a restraining order because of a legal problem he'd had with his wife. He apparently tried to kidnap their children. And people who are under restraining orders aren't supposed to own guns. And we believe that's the source of the original charge that helped draw attention to him and that police were actually looking for him for last night. Now police have to make the link to the sniper. Basically, they have to prove that these guys shot the bullets, and they'll probably do this by figuring out whether this gun, in fact, was the source of those shots.
Now, there are some reports, the Associated Press, saying they found a sniper scope and a tripod and the weapon in the trunk of the car that was picked up this morning. Is there any confirmation of any of that yet?
We have not been able to confirm that. Of course, that would be interesting. It could be incriminating, but it's not necessary in order to link these people to the crimes.
Now, when you were on the program yesterday, the conversation was still about notes at the crime scene, tarot cards, phone calls. Still, at that point, no real clues in the case. Walk us through the last 24 hours and what happened that finally, if this is the break in the case, how that happened.
Well, as best as we can tell, all of that other stuff, the notes that were left behind and everything, didn't actually lead the police to these men. That information may still be very important in court, for example, if they find a fingerprint on one of those notes or an indication that one of these men wrote the notes. If they find fingerprints on the bullet casings, that will help prove that these men did it, if in fact they did. But it appears that somebody calling into the tip line actually helped form the link. Somebody has been calling repeatedly saying, I am the sniper. He's been trying to get police's attention. He's been frustrated, according to many reports, that he wasn't getting through, that police weren't taking him seriously enough. So he said to them, if you don't think I'm serious, I'm not only responsible for the sniper shootings, I'm responsible for this murder that happened in connection with a robbery of sorts in Montgomery, Alabama, except he said, check with the folks in Montgomery. And somebody said, maybe he doesn't mean Montgomery County, maybe he means Montgomery, Alabama.
Just to reinforce that possible set of confusion, a lot of the shootings have happened in Montgomery County, Maryland. And I guess they thought initially when he said Montgomery, that's what he meant. And then somebody said, no, wait a minute, let's try Montgomery, Alabama.
And that's good police work. I mean, you know, we've criticized people, the police a lot in the last few days, but that was good thinking on their part. They came up with this other shooting, and this seems to have led them to John Malveau through a very circuitous path. But it seems to be this call that helped get them started.
Okay. Right now, we're going to go to some of the locations that have been folded into this story in the last 24 hours. Joining us right now on the phone from Montgomery, Alabama, is reporter Melanie Peoples, a frequent contributor to NPR News. Melanie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Neil.
Tell us a little bit more about the crime that was committed, I gather, at a Montgomery liquor store last month.
That's right. It was a crime that killed one woman and injured another. Happened September 21st at 7:30 at night on a busy road. The two women who worked at the liquor store, it was a state liquor store, were locking it up, closing it down for the night, and as they stood there outside the door, they were shot. A man approached them and with a handgun shot one in the back of the neck and one in the back. And then the man started going through one of the women's purse. And it was about that time that the police showed up, and they gave chase, but the man outran them. And since then, the police here had just been investigating that crime, trying to find out who was responsible for that killing, you know, here in Montgomery. They had no idea that it might come into play with the sniper shootings. And, in fact, the gun that was used in the crime here in Montgomery, in Alabama, was not the same sort of gun that's been used in the sniper attacks.
Again, just to reinforce that, the gun used in the liquor store robbery in Alabama is not the same gun. They've ruled it out as the same gun that was used in the Washington area sniper attacks.
That's right. It was a .22 caliber here, a handgun, they believe, and whereas a .223 rifle had
right.
been used in the D.C. area.
So what are the similarities between these two
crimes? Well, there's the tip that Larry was talking about, the whole reason that the task force started looking down in Montgomery, Alabama. And one of the things that when the sniper task force calls Montgomery, they find out is that from this liquor store crime, the police in Montgomery, Alabama have a fingerprint. And this fingerprint is because when the gunman fled the parking lot of the liquor store, he dropped a magazine. It was actually a publication about firearms. And they think that the magazine was wrapped around the gun, sort of concealing the handgun
mm-hmm.
when the shooter first approached the two women. But so they lifted a fingerprint, and the mayor of Montgomery says that, you know, quote, unofficially, it's connected. And there have been reports that this fingerprint belongs to John Lee Malveau, the 17-year-old who's in custody. And so what the Montgomery Police Department is saying is that it wasn't until this came into play that, you know, quote, the case broke open.
Mm-hmm.
And that this fingerprint is what led the sniper task force to the two men who were taken into custody this morning. So there's the tip, the fingerprint, and then there are the physical characteristics. The police officer who chased the gunman outside the liquor store was able to get within a few feet of him, and he has said that there are physical similarities between the man he chased on foot here in Montgomery, Alabama, and one of the two men in custody.
But was it the man whose fingerprint it was, or was it the other man, Muhammad?
That's what they aren't saying, and that's what you haven't been able to get the police to confirm.
So there does seem to be a link with this 17-year-old Malveau and the crime in Alabama, and that's what led them subsequently to make the break in the sniper case.
That's right. They found the fingerprint and were able to get a name from that, and there were some reports that they were looking for John Lee Malveau, and that's also what led them to John Allen Muhammad. That Malveau had been staying with him.
Now, how are authorities there in Montgomery, Alabama, reacting to this development?
Well, I talked to the chief of police and the mayor, and while they both said that they're disappointed in the sense to have this kind of connection to something as horrible as these sniper attacks, they are extremely excited that Montgomery police footwork here has helped lead to what may be the solving of the crime of who has been the snipers. And that's something that the police and officials here are very excited about. The people of Montgomery, you know, they put bluntly, they have they think the thought that the sniper's been down here where they are is it scares them. They're mm-hmm. glad that he didn't go on a killing spree here. He did kill one woman. They feel sorry for her and her family, and they feel sorry for the people in D.C. who've had to live through all this. And they sort of say it's one of the senses that in Alabama, you know, with terrorism, especially after September 11th, this has been one of the times that you could be pleased that you lived down here. You were safe. Sort of had the sense that no one out there would have considered Alabama important enough to target, and this just kind of plants the idea in their head that it is possible for terrorism to come home here.
Well, Melanie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Melanie Peoples, a reporter, a frequent contributor to NPR News, and she joined us by phone from Montgomery, Alabama. Joining us now from Seattle, Washington, is NPR's Robert Smith. And Robert, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Remind us again now, how and when did Washington State become part of this story?
Well, we're not sure exactly when FBI investigators began to look at Washington State, but we do know that yesterday, all day yesterday, in fact, FBI investigators and ATF agents combed a backyard of a duplex in Tacoma, Washington, and they set up a grid. They searched it with metal detectors, and they ended up cutting out two stumps and hauling them away. News cameras carried all of this live, and it became people realized that at least this investigation had come to Western Washington. We also know that FBI agents were up north of Seattle in a town called Bellingham, and they were searching Bellingham High School for records of the young man involved, the man of interest, mm-hmm. Malvo. And they were asking questions there, and we don't know exactly what they got, but we know that they were there and that they were taking records and asking questions.
Well, you've been asking questions all day, too. What can you tell us about John A. Williams? What do you know about him?
Well, we're starting to piece this together. We know he was born in 1960. We don't know exactly where he was born, but we know he spent part of his childhood in Louisiana. Then we sort of pick up the trail here in Washington. He trained as a machinist at Fort Lewis, which is outside of Tacoma, Washington, very close to that house where they were searching yesterday. He served in the Gulf War. We know he spent some time, we don't know how much, at Fort Ord, California. And then after he was discharged, he came back to Tacoma, Washington, where he had trained as a machinist. And in fact, he worked as a car mechanic. He had his own business. And he tried to start a karate business with another man. People are coming forward to try and say what his personality was like. You know, some say he had a sense of humor. Others say he was very quiet. But we do know from speaking to his business partner that he had perhaps embellished his Army background a little bit, saying he was mm-hmm. in the Special Forces. And this business partner says he also didn't seem terribly obsessed with guns or killing, but that he did say that he was often unhappy with the government. And we didn't have any more specifics on that, but we got this from his business partner, who said that when government issues came up, he seemed clearly distressed.
Okay. We just have a minute left. What do we know so far about John Lee Malvo?
We know less about him. We know he's 17 years old and a Jamaican citizen. We know he spent some time at Bellingham High School. I talked to his karate teacher, who said that he was an odd kid who would sometimes pick on younger kids, but then would burst into tears when reprimanded. So that's what we know so far about Malvo.
Any confirmation of reports that he is the stepson of Mr. Muhammad?
They certainly claim to be related. They claim to be father-son, but we don't know how they were actually related.
NPR's Robert Smith, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Robert Smith joined us from his office in Seattle, Washington. When we come back from a short break, more questions with Larry Abramson, who's been following this case, and we'll take your calls on the developments in the sniper case. Again, two men believed to be John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo have been arrested in Frederick, Maryland, northwest of Washington, D.C. The rifle found in their car is being tested to see if it matches the bullets fired in the sniper case. Back shortly. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what may be a big break in the series of sniper murders in and around Washington, D.C. Later in the program, we're going to switch our focus and take you to Moscow to bring you the latest on the hostage crisis in the Russian capital. But for now, more on the sniper case. Our guest is NPR's Larry Abramson, who's with us here in Studio 3A. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Larry, how do these recent developments, the arrest of these gentlemen, how does this fit into the ongoing work of the police in this case? Does it seem like they got a lucky break, or does it seem like these recent developments are connected to what they've been doing the past 3 weeks?
Well, it does seem like they got a lucky break in that this connection between the Montgomery shooting, the liquor store robbery, and these other killings wouldn't appear obvious to anybody else. But I think we should also say that there may be a lot that police are holding on to that we don't know. And as proud as we may be of our leaks, there's usually a lot going on there that we don't know about. There are thousands of police officers who've been working on this case, and I think it's safe to say that if some facts have leaked out, some have not. So there may be many other connections that we will learn about later on. As you said, a lot of the information that they were getting from the notes that the sniper appeared to have been leaving behind, from the telephone communications that he was making overtly to them, don't seem to have helped. But again, it was a call from the person who said he was a sniper to the police tip line that seems to have formed this link. And again, if they're getting 67,000 police tips and this one jumps out, that speaks to a decent system of prioritization, that if somebody said, hey, wait a minute, this is important, because, you know, a lot of people have wondered, are the police overwhelmed in these tips? So I guess you have to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, yes, it fits in with some of the stuff that they were doing.
Okay. Let's get listeners involved. Our first caller is Ed, who joins us from Webster Groves, Missouri.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. The question that I have, I'm a little bit confused. The person that was communicating with Chief Moose earlier had asked that he make a statement about catching the sniper like a duck in a noose or something to that effect. And where I'm confused is, if I was a sniper, why would I want Chief Moose to make this kind of a statement knowing that I was about to be caught?
Well, he may not have known he was about to be caught, but Larry, you may know better than I.
Well, that's right. And for those who weren't paying as close attention, Chief Moose last night, after he issued these, announced these warrants, he said, communicated to this person who says he's the sniper, you want us to say we have caught the sniper like a duck in a noose. Some people, after some digging, found some old Indian folktale which talks about a duck who is snared in a noose by a rabbit, but then the rabbit is later dragged by the duck into a tree stump. And so it's the case of being hoisted by your own petard. Why a killer would want to hear that said on television, I don't know. But on the other hand, I don't know why anybody would kill 10 people and wound 3 others. So one almost has to suspend one's rationality in this case and not presume that these things are going to make sense. I agree. It's very strange.
Yeah, it defies rational thought.
Yeah. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Larry, everybody said this was a high-risk strategy to communicate with the person who said he was the sniper after first the tarot card and then later the note and the phone calls. If the tip works out, if, in fact, one of these phone calls led to Montgomery, Alabama, and led to the tip that broke the case, that's going to vindicate this strategy.
Right. Well, police have had to decide, how are they going to deal with this guy? Are they going to show him respect? Are they going to deal with him on the same level as he's dealing with them? He apparently, according to some reports, was very angry that he wasn't getting enough respect, that he wasn't getting through on the tip line. Chief Moose always delivered his messages back in a very flat voice and said, you know, exactly what the person asked them to do. We're doing the best we can. We can't get through to you. Those kinds of things. But there's a lot of controversy about whether or not you acknowledge those things. Another thing that was controversial was that Chief Moose never released those letters that were left behind. Some people thought he should have, because maybe somebody would have recognized the handwriting, a la what we saw with the Unabomber, where a family member
that was
recognized
the style of writing rather than the it was typed.
Right.
But anyway,
right. One or the other could have helped, and he decided not to do that. So they clearly made some difficult decisions, and some of them may well be vindicated by this.
Our next caller is Madi, who joined us on the line from St. Louis.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm happy whoever did this crime should face the justice system. To my surprise, I hear the media using the word Islam. Islam do respect the life, and Islam doesn't teach people to be violent and kill other human beings. I'll hang up and listen to the...
Well, thanks very much for the question. Larry, why is the... we keep mentioning that he is a recent convert to Islam.
Right. Actually, I believe he converted to Islam 17 years ago. I think he only changed his name a year ago to Muhammad, John Allen Muhammad from John Allen Williams. And this is a very sensitive issue, obviously, after 9/11, even before that. There is no indication that this man had any ties to terrorism. Given the region of the country that this case is tied to, namely the Pacific Northwest, one has to nose around a little bit and see. The area is known to have a lot of dissident groups in it. And, of course, there a Seattle Muslim is being held right now on a federal terrorism charge named James Ujamaa. There's no indication that he's tied to them. There's no indication that he's tied to the six people who were arrested for connections to al-Qaeda. They actually were from Portland, Oregon, but they did some shooting training in southern Washington. And I think your caller brings up a very good point that we have to be cautious about this. We're simply trying to describe as much information about this man as we can, but these associations will come about. There's no reason to think that this man was any kind of terrorist yet.
Let's go to Brett, who's on the line with us from Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Hi there.
Hi.
The one question that I would like to hear discussed is the responsibility of the media to filter information so as to not report on information that could potentially have allowed the sniper to continue to remain free. Specifically, there were times when I saw and heard reports where in order to, I'm going to guess, advance their careers, reporters were identifying where roadblocks were set up and things like that. Don't you think that that is inappropriate? And not really news, but more trading career advancement for public safety?
Larry, let me put it to you. I mean, this is some degree, obviously, a lot of this is he's talking about local news, but there's a lot of this on CNN and MSNBC and the cable outlets as well.
Right. We, being a broadcast outlet nationally, have the luxury of not having to say where the traffic jams are. We always just said there were traffic jams after the police dragnet. I think you raise a good point. I'm not a traffic reporter, so I can't imagine what they feel their responsibilities are reporting traffic jams every few minutes. I imagine it gets pretty routine telling people where traffic is slow. And I think also many of those traffic reporters acceded to police requests not to specify where the traffic jams were, or at least to wait a while.
But I wasn't talking about traffic jams. I'm talking about police roadblocks where police were stopping and checking cars. They were reporting on the exact locations of that, and oftentimes news helicopters from national outlets would provide live feeds showing where the police were deployed. And if I were a bad guy, I would want nothing better than to be able to see where my enemy was.
Yeah, you raise a good point. It's one of the traps of the modern age, I suppose. I guess I also have to say this. I live near one of these checkpoints. They kept putting them up in my neighborhood for some reason. And I knew that if I saw traffic backing up, it was pretty easy to flip a U-ey and get out of the way. I don't know that police expected that they were going to catch everybody in the dragnet, and certainly the gunman in this case would have had the same intelligence that I had, even if he hadn't been listening to the radio, to just watch where the traffic was backing up. These things were not seamless nets that nobody could escape from.
Well, no, I understand that, but my point is that neither you nor I are trained law enforcement people, and so we don't really know what the right thing and the wrong thing to do is, and neither you nor I were willing to step in front of a car and risk our lives to try and find the sniper. And I just wonder where our own personal restraint should be set so that we don't interfere with what has obviously been a very successful investigation, because they did bring down, apparently, the sniper in a relatively, although not short enough, but a relatively short period of time. I mean, I think they deserve a lot of credit for the work they did.
Well, Brett, we do have to say, apparently, got the guy. You live in Gaithersburg, which is not too far from where some of the shootings are. Are you breathing a little easier?
Well, I'd like to know that this is the guy. From what it sounds like, they have the guy. And although I refuse to modify my personal behavior, just like I didn't change anything I did after 9/11, I got to tell you that I will fill my tank up a little bit more frequently than just get a couple dollars worth.
Yeah. Brett, thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Joining us now by phone from his home in Silver Spring, Maryland, is Jonathan Kronstadt. He's a freelance writer there, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Any comfort? Same thing I was asking Brett, who lives not all that far away from you. Do these arrests, no proof yet, but do these arrests make you a little calmer?
Oh, yes, they make me a lot calmer. I think it would be pretty irresponsible of law enforcement to trot out these suspects with the degree of certainty that they seem to be trotting them out with, unless they had a pretty good case.
Hmm. Everybody's been so skittish, it's hard to imagine they'll get back to normal right away.
No, it won't get back to normal right away. And we're all cautious enough, I think, by now to be wary that there are, you know, potentially copycats or, you know, aftershocks that are involved in this. But you get the sense that there's a collective sigh of relief. And for those of us that were fairly well going about our lives with, you know, certain sensible precautions, I think we'll be anxious to get back to, you know, whatever passed for normal.
Do you have kids?
Yes.
Well, obviously, one of the most chilling things was not only, of course, the one child who was shot, but then the threat issued just a couple of days ago against children.
Yes, that was very chilling. And it's very difficult because I come from a long line of risk-averse people, and I've tried not to pass that on to my kids. So you try and keep your life as normal as possible while still, you know, being sensible. We had the kids play in the backyard. We felt it was safe there. The problem is that because kids live with fear every day of various things, and my kids are 8 and 5, and my 5-year-old really doesn't have any way to process this kind of information in a meaningful way to him. The only thing he would think was that maybe the sniper was in his closet. And so we talked to our kids about the fact that there are bad people out there, and there was a bad person out there doing some really bad things, but we were confident that we could keep them safe and that they should talk to us about their fears, and we sort of dealt with it on a day-by-day and case-by-case basis. We really have to guard against overreacting with kids because their worlds are so big and sometimes scary. Even, you know, the most mundane things can scare them, that this kind of thing could really paralyze them.
Well, I wonder, did they see other people around them, your neighbors, your friends, whatever, changing their behavior noticeably?
I think what they noticed probably more than anything else was the fact that they weren't going outside at school every day.
Yeah.
And things like soccer was canceled. But surprisingly, they were, and these are just my kids. I don't know about, you know, I think our friends, I think to a certain extent, the parents seem to be much more concerned about it than the kids, because the kids are so much in the moment, and they're so, you know, wrapped up with their friends and their activities that, you know, they understood that something was going on, but they don't have the ability to obsess over it like we do, I think.
I guess one thing, if this does turn out to be confirmed that these were the snipers, it'll at least liberate Halloween.
It will liberate Halloween. And it was interesting because the neighborhood that I live in, there's a listserv, and there was a lot of talk about what was going to happen with Halloween. And I think my wife and I had predetermined that we were not going to let the sniper take Halloween away from our kids. I think since 9/11, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, to what degree do you change your life and to what degree do you give up and let the terrorist/criminal element win by, you know, really changing things. And Halloween was just something that we were not prepared to give up.
Well, Jonathan Kronstadt, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Kronstadt, a freelance writer who was on the line with us from Silver Spring, Maryland. We're talking about the developments in the sniper case. Later in the program, we will switch gears and talk about the ongoing situation in a Moscow theater where hundreds of people are being held hostage. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get back to the phones. Larry Abramson is still with us here in Studio 3A. Charles in Seattle is our next caller.
Yeah, I guess I would like to have somebody comment on the success of profiling and white vans, and tell us why these guys could find their way out of a wet paper bag. It seems to me that they were just about as useful as the X-Files in some of their notices to the public. The other, you had a caller previously who was eager to deny the violence of Islam. It seems to me that, you know, when we have a few more muftis who say that, gee, Gandhi might have had the right idea, Martin Luther King might have had the right idea, bomb carriers don't have the right idea, that we would be a little more willing to believe that Islam was not a violent religion. But, you know, that's a different show.
That's a different show.
What I was mostly interested in was to find out, just how good are the profilers when the people that they were looking for don't turn out to be anything like the people they arrested?
Hmm. Larry?
Well, you raise a very good point. We have heard from a lot of profilers over the past few weeks, and I have to confess, as a journalist, one turns to certain experts when one has few facts. And profilers deserve a lot of credit because they operate without a whole lot of facts. But I think that we at least try to show that profiling is a tool. It narrows the field. It gives you something to go on. It's not a roadmap, and, you know, it has a lot of flaws in it. And I don't think that I think most good profilers would admit that. I think also, you know, what we saw is, as you mentioned, they were may have been following a lot of the wrong cars around. There were reports of a Chevy Caprice having been seen at the Manassas slaying, I believe it was. And people raised that, but it wasn't confirmed a lot. Well, it might be that the witness who brought that up just didn't sound quite as sure, or maybe only one witness brought it up, whereas 10 people saw the white van. And it could be serendipity that allowed that detail to get buried in the other details.
Another bit of serendipity. I read one remark or one notice that the tipster who called in the sighting of the Caprice in the lot in Frederick was driving a white van.
Well, there are a lot of them, aren't there? Suddenly we're all aware of how many of them there are.
Charles, thanks very much for the call. Larry, we just have a few seconds left. Where do we go next on this story? What's going to be following later today?
Well, I think that we're waiting to hear the ballistics information, as I said. If there are signs that there was a gun in the car that was used in these slayings, clearly all signs point to these guys. I hate to say this, but people are also going to be waiting for the killings to actually stop for several days at a time. And I think that people will be in a little bit of fear until we have some peace around here for a prolonged period.
NPR's Larry Abramson. Thanks very much, Larry.
Thank you, Neil.